Hello, sweet listeners. Kaffirs here. Before we begin our stimulating and thrilling discussions, I would like to say a few pleasant words about our sponsors. The Baker Street Journal is a leading Sherlockian publication, with articles written by the readers for the readers. It features not only discussions of an academic nature, but also fun, light reading for any sort of Sherlock Holmes enthusiast. The BSJ is a central reading for any fan of the great detective Sir Arthur Conan Doyle and fanatical mustache appreciation. The Scintillation of Sion is an annual symposium of fans for Arthur Conan Doyle and his creations. It is sponsored by Watson's Tin Box and Merrillen USA. You can find out more information about the next event at www.scintillation.org. Wessex Press and their imprint, Gastian Books, are premier publishers of Sherlock Holmes-related material. They are also our publishers. The One Fixed Point in a Changing Age, A New Generation of Sherlock Holmes, is an essay collection by online fans. It is edited by several of the Baker Street Babes, with a foreword by Laurie R. King, the author of the Mary Russell series. The book will be available for purchase at BSI Weekend and exclusively online at www.wessexpress.com from the 18th of January. On the same day, Christina Menente will be signing copies of the book at the BSI Dealers Room in the Roosevelt Hotel in New York City. The book is 280 pages long and is priced at $24.95.
Oh, Scotland Yard, they send you home. You feel like you're losing your mind. If this quotidian world has got you crying, won't you two unwind?
So welcome to the 50th Baker Street Babe podcast. Today we'll talk about the Sign of Three, but before that we have to congratulate someone. An old man who turns 160 on Monday, and that is the man himself, Sherlock Holmes.
Hello!
Happy birthday!
Happy birthday!
160 years young.
Birthday to the beekeeper.
Today is a podcast full of celebration because it's the 50th, and of course, there's a wedding to talk about today. The wedding of John Watson and Mary Morstan. We start. Basically, I'll go through the episode again, as we did with the last episode. So we start with a nod to the Red-Headed League, actually, and Lestrade being extremely...
perturbed.
Perturbed, aggressive, kicking his car. And we have Donovan, who's trying to keep calm in all of this. And so we have the sort of the dark knightish underground bank robbery, which is a clear reference to the Red-Headed League. So what were your reactions to sort of having Lestrade start this episode?
There can just never be enough silver fox in Sherlock, is my take on this. And I'd been wishing for more screen time for him since the end of Series 1, and it's nice that it's finally happening because they're kind of like taking off my wish list with this episode, and I just super appreciate him there.
No, it was really great to have him for that entire full section with Donovan. It was lovely to see her again. And the reason, because I know a lot of people were asking us, like, why is Donovan not in the first episode? She was filming like a pilot or something in California. So this is why now she's back, which is so.
Yeah, but she's back and she's still snarky and she still doesn't like Sherlock Holmes, which is nice, you know, going for the character development, which was a bit wonky in the first episode, but so she's sort of stably hating Sherlock Holmes, keeping doing that. So that's
she
sort
has
of,
pretty good reason, though. I mean,
yeah,
like,
it's
if you watch A Study in Pink, it's like, oh my god, yeah. I mean, like, I wouldn't be forgetting any of that anytime soon. Yeah. Even if I mean, and she does, of course, turn out to be her and Anderson. They're wrong that he's, you know, the mastermind of a huge criminal conspiracy and a murderer, etc. But, you know, that doesn't mean you have to go out for a pint with the dude.
True.
I think there will always be that like animosity. That word.
Animosity.
Animosity. Yeah, that thing between them.
Yeah, so we have that, and basically it's Lestrade finally solving a case that he's been working on for 18 months, and then he gets a call for help in a form of a text, capitalized letters.
Yeah, and it makes you think that, like, oh my god, something horrible is about to happen. But I guess knowing sort of what the episode was going to be about, you're like, oh my god, this is going to happen. My favorite thing.
Exactly. And let's try orders maximum backup.
Choppers.
Oh god.
It's amazing.
It was the most beautiful, like, joke setup I've ever seen in one of the episodes. Cause I knew, I was like, it's not going to be an emergency. It's just going to be him, like, being ridiculous. Like, just him being like, Lestrade, I need you, tantrum.
He completely panicked and called in all the backup. I was like, it's going to be nothing.
The hardest thing he's ever had to do. Apparently even harder than jumping off a rope. Writing best man's speech. And not having any funny stories about John, which is sort of telling.
Which he has like 900. He just, like, their sense of humor is so skewed. Both of them, like both his and John's. And it was like brought back in The Empty Hearse as well, like at the end of the train car sequence where he's like, killing me so 2 years ago. But John actually laughs at it. And he knows that only the two of them have this sense of humor. So he's like, I don't have funny stories. What are funny stories? What does funny mean?
Yeah. And I mean, during the speeches, the same thing happens. It's like, John is the only one laughing out loud at all the jokes that are just funny to him and nobody else gets it. I love that.
Mm-hmm.
That is very sweet. One of the things that I absolutely adore about the episode is, like, the way that we are shown a lot of really good character development and how, like, Sherlock's friends have come to care for him.
Yeah.
Which obviously happens a little bit later, but the writing of the best man speech was just fantastic. The whole sequence, like, leading up to that is brilliant.
All the and little details at the beginning, like, as well, just, he's already composing the waltz during the helicopter thing. Like, like the windows are open and it's just like, you know, chopper breeze blowing in and there's sheet music fluttering around. And Sherlock's just like, no, I need help with this. This is really important.
Exactly. And then we have this amazing sequence with Mrs. Hudson bringing his morning tea. And this is something, another thing that I want on a t-shirt, is Sherlock, you know, thinking that tea just happens. he's always asleep when she brings up the tea and he just figured, you know, it just appears out of nowhere.
Can we have a tea happens t-shirt?
I want that so badly. So bad.
That's a good
one. That's going to be in the Big Street Babe shop in the future.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and I just love that scene because it's so obvious. Again, it's sort of a reference to The Empty Hearse as well, where Sherlock just can't deal with the emotional aspect of it, because Mrs. Hudson starts talking about her best friend and how everything changes and how, you know, how everything changed and how the wedding changes everything, basically, in between her best friend, who then basically disappeared from her life and who was the first one to leave the party. And Sherlock just, he can't deal with it, so he just basically yells at her to bring her biscuits. Which is really nice, because it comes back to this aspect of Sherlock not being able to deal with things and therefore sort of doing something completely else and being rude.
Yeah, he doesn't deal with it at all. And then she leaves and then he just stares at John's chair for like 2 seconds.
And there's four stupid notes playing. You're like, no. Yeah. No.
Well, what I really like about that is so there's a lot of foreshadowing in the episode when a lot of people are saying, you know, that line is repeated quite a few times, like, you know, everything changes when you get married. And the whole way through you're kind of thinking, nah, it'll never change. And obviously, you know, right at the end.
we're not going there yet. Shut the fuck up.
Not going there.
But also, what I found quite sweet about it also is it starts with that scene with Mrs. Hudson where she says, you know, I lost my best friend pretty much. She got married and then she disappeared. And you're like, oh my God, no, Sherlock's going to lose John and, you know, it's going to be horrible. And you can see the pain in his face as well. And it happens a couple of times throughout that episode. Mm-hmm. And what I love about the episode is basically throughout that whole episode, he tries to be that person who doesn't lose John. He tries to be that person that John's going to come back to.
Yeah.
And, you know, that was just so nice.
It was. I think it was. The one thing as well I quite liked about this episode is you find out more and more about Mrs. Hudson. Like, we've
you
never
do,
really explored like her past and, like, why she married, you know, this guy who turned out to be, you know, a total nutter. But, like, it's really interesting how... Yeah, it was only a physical thing. I just thought that was great. It's just, it gives you, like, gives her such a, like, such dimension. I just love it.
Yeah, fantastic.
Yeah, but something I thought was very poignant is that when Sherlock's getting ready to put on, you know, his morning suit and whatever, he says going into battle. Because one, like, and I think it's set up throughout the entire episode that he's obviously dreading this, but he's so obsessive about it and so, like, wants it to happen, and so it's the faster it happens, the sooner it's over, that sort of thing, which I think actually Mary comments on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But just that whole, like, going into battle, so he's putting on, like, his armor to sort of, like, get ready to effectively, I guess, not lose his best friend, but it's a big change, and he doesn't know how to deal with it.
Yeah, and I love the cut that follows it, where we could, like, get to Major Sholto, who is actually getting dressed in his uniform, so it's sort of a really neat link between the inter-battle and that scene. And of course, that moment is also quite interesting, because it, like, I think in the beginning, we all think it's sort of John getting dressed. He might
I thought it was
in his uniform. Mm-hmm. And then we see, like, the hand and the bands. I think it might be the actual Moran, like, in the canon version, but then it's neither. And it's just Major Sholto, who, you know, obviously is a reference to the Sign 4. So I really, really liked that cut and what they did with it. And that kept us guessing for a while. And then we just have a gorgeous wedding.
The wedding. Yeah. Like, at first I was a little sad, like, oh, we don't get to see the actual ceremony. And then I remember how boring wedding ceremonies are. So I was quite glad we skipped it.
I've been to so many weddings. I was like, thank you. We didn't need to see that.
Didn't have to go there. But then when the photographer's like, just the happy married couple, and Sherlock doesn't move.
Oh man, that's so funny.
It's so funny, and it's so cute how running a theme that is throughout the whole thing, because it's really obvious to Mary that Sherlock Holmes is the other most important person in John's life. And it's so the person from the very beginning of the Boscombe Valley mystery, where John Watson gets a telegram from Holmes that's basically like, oh, can you just quit being a doctor for 2 days? I need you. And Mary's like, you're looking pale. Yeah, you should go solve crime for sure. Yeah. Get out. And she's so that same person, like, in this episode, throughout the episode. And Sherlock feels completely comfortable just being like, yeah, no, I'm part of this. It's the three of us. Yeah. Oh, I should move. Okay.
Yeah.
No problem.
That was one of the things I really loved about Mary being introduced, is that straight away, like, you know what kind of person she is. You know, she's looking out for not just John, but she realizes that Sherlock is like an extension of John, and that you can't have one without the other, and they kind of need to look after each other in a way. So that whole scene where she gets them to go out and, like, go on a mystery together is just beautiful.
She really understands that she's marrying, like, one half of one functioning person. So, like, the other half has to be, you know, in play to a certain extent, or else everything is going to disintegrate all too quickly.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed the domestic sequences as well, when they're in 221B and, like, sorting out serviettes and whatever, because, you know, that's kind of Sherlock and John's place. But Mary's now in there as well, and it works. And I really appreciate that.
I like that they did it in 221B Baker Street as well. Like, it's like they didn't do it in Mary's, like, home where John has been living. They did it in Baker Street, like, with Sherlock. Like, he was implicitly included in that, even though he obviously, like, was having a mental breakdown.
It would have been such an easy characterization for the show writers to have said, well, obviously, this version of Sherlock, he has a really hard time communicating with people on an emotional level, and he is completely against convention in any way. So it's going to be obvious that he'd be a complete shit best man. And they did the complete opposite, where he's this amazing best man and starts accidentally, like, making origami swans out of napkins. It's like, completely obsessed with this project in aspects that no best man would ever give a shit about, and he's just, like, overcompensating to the point of, like, no best man has ever had to care about what kind of serviettes you have at your wedding, but Sherlock is like, this is really important, and then starts just you know, like, micromanaging the guest list and, like, all of these.
I love that moment. I loved it,
and it was such a good storytelling choice, because it wasn't the obvious route that they could have taken, where it's all just this complete, you know, Sherlock in La La Land and a terrible choice of best man. He's actually an amazing best man, and he cares so much about it that he's doing way too much.
It seems like he read what the responsibilities of a best man were, and then took the more traditional route of sort of being the husband-to-be's bodyguard and acting as a very sort of protective person. So one of the things that I liked so much was how he downgraded the usher to casual acquaintance, no more than 3 planned social encounters a year, always in John's presence, after deducing that he still got a thing for Mary because he is taking his role as best man very seriously.
I also quite like that that kind of makes me think that Sherlock is now considering Mary to be an extension of John as well. Because they complete the Triforce together. That's the term I'm going to now use for the three of them.
Triforce is good. No, he sees her, I think that is so apt, Catherine, because he sees her as under his protection now that she is, just like you said, like a part of John, like an extension of John. And so now, like, she's in this circle of trust. She's under his umbrella. And it's like, this is a person that I am now going to expand my very, 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 very small list of people, you know, for whom I would really go out of my way. And she is part of that because he loves her. And I, therefore, will do what I can to make sure that everything goes smoothly for them. And it, that was awesome. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and in a way that that notion even extends to Major Sholto, because John obviously cares about him, and Sholto obviously cares enough about John to show up, even though he never goes anywhere. And that's when he starts, you know, doing research and trying to find out what kind of person he is, which I think has to do with the same notion that he tries to really, you know, pay attention to who John actually has around him to sort of figure out how he can refit himself into this life that John obviously has. So he, for the first time, he actually starts to note the social sort of surroundings of John's. So that's really quite nice to see.
I think that's probably one of the major character developments that we see from Sherlock in these first two episodes, is that it's no longer just him and John going on adventures. Yeah. He has to kind of extend his, I don't know, like his umbrella, like, you know, the analogy we've used before, to cover all these other people. And it's kind of like new territory for him to have to consider, you know, the people that are connected to John and the people who are connected to him as being, you know, part of a network, as opposed to just sort of people that are at his disposal, I guess.
And he's so egotistical that he finds that extremely difficult, because he has that wonderful little conversation with Mary at the very beginning of the wedding ceremony where she's saying, oh, no, he talks about him all the time. He talks about him all the time? He talks about Sholto all the time? No. He's like, that can't possibly be. Just, yeah, he says he's one of the most isolated, unsociable people in the entire world. So it's like, no, that's me. No, that's me. You don't know. And he's like losing it a little bit. And she goes, listen. You weren't there first. I wasn't there first. He loves us. It's okay. Like, she's just kind of calming him down. He's like, stop smiling and, like, you know, strides off in this sort of puff, because it's really hard for him to try to just expand to include all these other folk. And he's like using her as this confidant on this subject.
Yeah. I really enjoyed, I think you have to give props to Amanda for her comedy chops, because with the wine and everything, I thought that was quite funny.
The noises she made.
I know it.
Oh, I want that gift so much, like her face when she drinks that wine. I want to use that at every opportunity. It's so good. It's like it like just takes up my feelings on a lot of subjects very well.
A surprise entrance of Mycroft. Hilarious. So I guess we all just screamed at that moment. Working out.
I didn't know I needed Mycroft in a tracksuit that badly. That was not a thing that I knew was a physical need that I had until it happened. It was like doing, you know, heroin or something, and now I'm addicted. Now I just have to look at Mycroft in a tracksuit like every 5 minutes, or I get really squirrely.
I was gonna say, it's of course the bit where he lifts up his shirt to kind of pat his belly a little bit. We've all been there, mate. We've all been there.
But what's really interesting, because they obviously they open it up with something very quite funny, but the conversation that he and Sherlock have is quite sobering, in the fact that I guess Mycroft's kind of trying to warn him and like, your life's gonna change now. He's like, no, it's not. He's like, no, it really is. I told you not to, you know, get involved, he keeps saying. But what I found really interesting is that ever since he got back from the hiatus, the Sherlock's like, I don't know, it's like he's leaning on Mycroft so much. But then we find out, you know, later on that, I don't know if Mycroft's like haunting him in some way. There's so much like psychological stuff there that I'm just like, where is this? Oh, this is really interesting. Where is this coming from?
And I've had some thoughts about that actually, but we can talk about it when we get to that bit.
I found it really interesting just that Sherlock would even call Mycroft right then and ask him. Obviously, he's asked him several times to come to the wedding. It was interesting to me, their relationship is so complex that in spite of sort of the weirdness that they have going on, he would actually, for his own sake, want the support of Mycroft there. So that was a really odd and interesting thing, I thought.
Mm-hmm. That was super cool, and I couldn't quite unpack whether it was out of him wanting Mycroft to be there, because obviously you see throughout the wedding process that he just kind of needs these like familiar faces near him, mm-hmm. so that he doesn't have to deal with strangers constantly, because it's extremely uncomfortable for him to be constantly, you know, just in this flood of unwashed humanity, right? But I couldn't really figure out whether it was more about that and that he wanted his brother there so that he could decompress it later for whatever reason, or have that family support, or whether it was out of respect for John. And out of saying, no, you come to this because this is important. And it's important to me because it's important to him. So now it needs to be important to you. So I couldn't quite figure out which angle. Yeah.
I think it's both, actually.
Mm-hmm. So. I think there is an element that Mycroft is a little bit of a safety blanket now that he's come back from sort of being dead, because Mycroft was the first one who kind of approached him about coming back, and now he kind of is like, well, I need to share my thoughts with someone, and the only person I know who like we'll kind of understand as Mycroft, like, despite mm-hmm. the weird relationship that we have, so.
Yeah.
And they were obviously, from that conversation, which was so interesting, he's making references to Sherlock as a child, and to mm-hmm. Sherlock depending on people, and to Sherlock having, you know, having attachments to friends, be they real or imaginary. I couldn't quite figure out what was going on during the Redbeard conversation, but their whole conversation, there's so many layers to it there, and Mycroft has clearly reached the conclusion that people are you know, that caring is not an advantage, and that whole conversation that they were having about caring not being an advantage is completely true to Mycroft, and Sherlock has figured out that that's not the case, that, you know, he's sort of evolved slightly further and is trying to help his brother understand that, and his brother's still sort of like, oh, well, that worked out great when you were six, caring, you know?
Yeah,
it's weird and interesting and really well written.
I'd quite like to say that I really love the direction in that part as well, the way like they also they use the way the scenes kind of chop between each other as Sherlock is walking in front of that sort of glass panes. I just thought there was a lot of that in the episode, actually. There was a lot of really interesting scene changes where I guess they must have used like a bit of, you know, FX or whatever it's called, you know, visual effects to kind of make, you know, certain parts of the scene disappear first and then appear. I thought it was very good.
I really enjoyed the directing style this go around. Like, I liked it in The Hearst because I thought it matched the episode quite well, even though it was very jerky. But I just think Colin McCarthy has done a beautiful job. Like, everything's just so beautifully lit and just the transitions are all really good. And like and we'll talk about Sherlock's mind palace later, but just like all of that was just so well executed, I think.
Yeah. And it needed to be, because the structure of the screenplay, the way they developed it, and there were like three show writers for this one, weren't there?
Yes.
Several people had their hands in it. Yeah. So like the way they wrote it is it's essentially like the backbone of the entire episode is Sherlock's best man toast. So you've got that as the backbone, and then everything branches off of that, and it almost sort of flows around it like a double fucking helix or something. Like, you're looking at this pattern of, okay, now it's a flashback. Okay, now it's a flashback, but to a domestic scene. Okay, now it's a case. Okay, now it's it all comes back to this spine of the best man toast. And if you didn't have a director who was really just had an elegant and delicate touch with that, it would have been confusing as fuck all to watch that episode. And it wasn't at all. I'm going to put my cat in the bedroom. Yeah. I'll be right back.
The best man speech. I mean, it sort of starts off with Sherlock not being able to say anything. You know, he just fumbles for words. And then he remembers, well, basically, the entire process of writing it, of composing it, of getting help from his friends, and then how John asks him to be his best man. And I've never seen a face that Fred cannot compute more than Sherlock's in that moment. I mean, that was just beautiful.
Yeah, that was the Comic-Con scene that we saw, John asking Sherlock. And from what I remember of them...
Oh, was it?
That was the Comic-Con scene, and just the sounds that this audience made, just the look on Sherlock's face, because he obviously just... he can't compute, like, he's coming to terms with the fact that, like, I actually mean this much to someone. And it's so touching. Like, he, even, like, when he's saying, like, I was very close to being moved, I'm like, you're lying, you were moved just because you couldn't function.
John broke Sherlock in half asking him to be the best man. He would smoke his whole brain.
That Watson didn't stop him from drinking the tea with the eyeball in it.
Yes.
It's just, that entire moment was like, I just looked at it and was like, yeah, you are the people that I've missed, and this is the relationship that I've missed. And it's back on my screen now, and I'm just so happy.
Yeah.
It was just perfect.
I loved that that John was not particularly reticent in that scene. He was very willing to verbalize everything he wanted to say there, and I thought the contrast between Sherlock, who is usually the one who knows what to say in every situation, being kind of completely dumbfounded, and John being the one who knows exactly what to say, was a really neat moment.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I mean the moment when he sort of, you know, sort of recaps John's life and what he's done, and then he sort of says he's sorry for all the recent, for the losses he's experienced, and especially for the recent one. So that was really a neat way of, you know, having him apologize again in front of, like, all of these people. Nobody knew what he was referring to, like, except for a handful of people. So I just really liked that moment because it was sincere, and it was, like, in that moment where he just needed to do it, and John was completely okay with it. So I really like the fact that he has now forgiven him. And that sort of showed in that moment. And then, of course, we have the hug and everyone crying. And I'm waiting for that hug for, like, you know, 5 years.
Ever?
And then Sherlock just doesn't get it. He's like, why are you all crying? No, I'm not done. I'm not done. I have more speech. Look, I have speech. Yeah. He's like, no, look. No.
No, that whole speech when it just turns when you think he's, you're like, oh god, he's being a dick again. But then it turns and just the line, like, I never thought I would be anyone's best friend. I'm like, oh my god. Like, and that's just so, like, indicative of Sherlock's character and now of his development of, like, and I think when a lot of, like, early reviews and stuff, including ours, have been that this episode is about Sherlock and John, how much they have and will continue to mean to one another, and Sherlock telling, like, saying that John's, like, the bravest and the wisest and the best of men, and that he saved him, which I thought was really, really important. And just the fact that John Watson was about to cry. Yes. Sherlock Holmes made John Watson cry by not jumping off of a building this time.
What's the line? It's like, it's so explicit that it's beautiful, and you never see it coming. But he says something along the lines of, "Okay, so, you know, and I'm your best man, and this is your bride, and you have flanked on either side of you the two people who love you the most in the world.
Yeah,
and we're never gonna let you down." And I was like, "Did you just say that?"
Like, yeah, I know. I was a bit like that as well. And I think John says it back at some point. He says, you know, he says something like, I love you both, or, you know, that
it was when he was asking, asking Sherlock to be his best man. He's like, there's two people who, like, I respect and I love the most, Mary Morstan and you. Yeah, so it's John saying, I love you, Sherlock, and Sherlock is now saying it back, which is just lovely.
Yeah, the bit I love the most about that whole scene as well, it was like Sherlock's complete confusion over all the reactions that the audience had. It's like the first time they laughed, just kind of looks at them like, "What? Why are you laughing?" And then, you know, when they all start crying, he's like, "What's wrong with all of you?" it's so Sherlock.
It's just like the same as him thinking that he doesn't have any funny stories about John, because he's got none that he thinks he can play to a crowd, essentially. Like, because they're always laughing together, but they're kind of a culture of two.
Yeah.
Well, three now. So.
Yeah. Can we talk about the silly cases?
Sorry,
Amy, go ahead.
I was just going to say canon references all through that speech.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Like, canon paraphrases, canon quotes. I mean, I was just taking them off, and I don't even know. There were probably tons that I didn't even realize, but...
We had Tonga as the poison giant case.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That was awesome. Yeah, and throughout the best man speech, you have all these bits from... a lot of them were from Sign of Four, but a lot of them were from, like you were saying, Amy, other cases that just, you know, they sort of it was like a mash... It was awesome.
Love and whatever are antithesis to my pure, whatever that quote is.
The beginning of Scandal in Bohemia. Like, Yeah, and he's saying it about himself as opposed to Watson writing it about him.
I just thought they did such a beautiful job of weaving several different things together in a way that if you didn't know what they were, it worked completely, and even if you did, they actually worked together really well. So I wanted to compliment whoever was responsible for weaving all of that together.
And then, of course, so we have the Hollow Client, we have the Poison Giant, we have the Inexplicable Matchbox.
Which, that one I was just like,
oh, yeah, that was pretty funny.
It's like, what is happening?
Did anyone think about, so like Melinda was saying, yes, the Tonga, I was like, oh my god, you're actually putting a small person with a blowgun on a rooftop. Amazing. You did that. Wow. I did not see that coming. But in the Matchbox case, is that Isadora Persano and the remarkable worm, unknown to science? Because it just sort of reminded me of that one, and I don't know why.
Yeah, I wasn't sure. The elephant in the room, I just laughed really loudly.
I love my
word. Yeah.
Just because their faces.
I think we all did.
I think certain parts of the fandom are going to enjoy that particularly.
Yeah. Possible.
Right, and then we have sort of the least funny, silly case, which is the Bloody Guardsman. But before we come to that story, of course, we have this neat episode that we already mentioned at 2D1B, where they basically plan the wedding, and Harry talks about very, very shortly being an orphan. Of course, that's canon, but mm-hmm. I wonder if that has something to do with the overall development of the series and Mary possibly being targeted.
We've missed something huge.
Oh, we did.
What? Sherlock is reading the telegrams before he starts his speech, there's one says, from Cam. So bad, your family couldn't be here to witness this. Cam is Charles Augustus Magnuson. You watch her facial expression. Like, she completely shuts down.
Perfect. Okay, so we know now that she is definitely targeted, and that Milverton has to do with that.
Yes.
So I guess
great moment, because John looks like he thinks she's upset because it was a mention of her family.
Yeah.
There's another layer there.
Yeah, definitely. And she's not that upset about being orphans. I mean, when Sherlock asks her, she's sort of, it's just how it is. But it's not something that seems to upset her. So that is definitely a nice clue. Good catch.
Oh, fantastic. You do not want the letter CAM showing up in your mailbox.
No.
Yep.
Ever.
Right. And then we have, of course, Sherlock YouTubing.
Swans, I swear to God. No best man in the history of the world has ever folded napkins. Sherlock's like, overcompensation is better than undercompensation.
And I love when they leave the room for 5 seconds and he's made, 20 of those Sydney Opera House ones and during the vlog, he goes, yeah, that just kind of happened.
It's the lost expression on his face as he looks up at them, like one of those dogs that you've left alone for too long and has destroyed the furniture.
Right, Maria. I think that's the point where Mary, looking at them, is just like, you two, get out. Yeah. Nope. he's losing it. He's losing it, and I could use you out of my hair at the moment, so I'm just going to be an adventure enabler, and you should go solve crime. Don't make napkins. Get out of here.
I love that. And how she motivates both of them to just, go out and be together, basically. I love that, how she handles it.
I really love the transition of them going to the guard grounds. Yeah. Just the transition of the going to the guard grounds with the marching. I just thought that was so fun and so well done. Just the whole, chunk, 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 and then the screen's moving, and then they're marching, and then the guards are marching. I really enjoyed it. Yeah.
It's Alfred Enoch, isn't it?
I thought it was a bit much.
Oh, Stephen Bainbridge. I think that's the actor's Alfred Enoch, who's Dean Thomas in Harry Potter.
Oh, it's Dean Thomas?
Yeah, I think so.
Yes.
Oh.
It's really funny because he was in Antigone together with Luke Newberry, who is, of course, the cute ginger extra. But anyway, he has a stalker. of course, that turns out to be one of the cases that Sherlock Holmes could not solve. A typical locked room mystery, one of the best he's encountered yet. So we get a very graphic description of that case, which is, of course, supposed to entertain the people at the wedding, but, as Sherlock Holmes, or as he usually behaves or thinks that things work, is not entertaining, and he's actually just trying to make the point that John Watson saves lives. So just to stress the point again that he saved him, that he saved others. So while he prevents crimes, John is the one who actually saves lives. So I found that, I mean, I really love that because it's such a, you know, he really tried. He just has no, you know, he has no idea how to actually convey that, but it's a really sweet way of doing it. Just telling this gruesome story of somebody being stabbed and then having this Q&A element.
And it's so clear in his head what the point of the story is.
Oh, there's,
I love the moment on the bench too, though, when they're outside the changing of the guard. The bench conversation is super
cute. Oh, yes.
Where John's like, you know, Mary completely changed my life, but she's not the only person who in the past few years completely changed my life. The other one is a total dickhead. Never mind.
We've also forgotten to mention another character that I particularly enjoyed who appeared earlier, which is little boy Archie. Because I've always kind of wondered how like Sherlock Holmes in this particular incarnation would react with children, and it was absolutely everything that I hoped for. He was like, "Do you want to see some murders?" Yeah. It's like, yeah, all right then. And he like shows him like horrific pictures of murders, and then they bond over that.
Yeah, something
always so good with kids, always. Like, and he has to be. It's just this huge part of the character. And if they had gotten that wrong, it would have been like, and they never would because they're such huge fans of the canon. But like, Sherlock has to be amazing with children despite everything else that's prickly about him. And I was just, I had my fingers crossed for a cool name for the kid. Like, Archie's cute, but I was like, be called Cartwright, be called Wiggins.
I love that Sherlock, we already talked about his conversation with Mycroft and Mycroft bringing up his childhood. Well, we had Archie saying why and Sherlock saying he'll ask a grown-up as if he himself is not a grown-up, which I totally love. That was one of my favorite lines, honestly, in the entire episode, is I don't know why grown-ups like that either, because I'm not one either.
Yeah,
that was good. It really reminded me of the kind of like Peter Pan attitude, you know, he's like the boy that never grew up, because Sherlock Holmes just continues to like have fun and basically do whatever he likes.
The thing that he comments on all the time, and especially in the end when he talks about the possible pregnancy, and he's like, you know, you've basically, you know, had me as your child, so now you have had good practice, so you can have an actual child. So it's like just the way he sees himself, like it's not quite grown up, not quite grasping how the world works. So that's really sweet. Speaking of immature behavior, we have the Stag Knight, of course.
I've never been so happy in my entire life as I was watching these scenes.
Oh my god, the bit where they're lying on the stairs together. I was just like, yep, been there.
Kind of starting with Molly being awesome, though, right?
Oh my god.
Like, we're going to drink for science. We're going to drink for science. So, like, listen, I need your help with science just for a second because I don't have really a lot of practice with this, but we're going to drink, like, scientifically. And she's looking at him like, oh god.
No, but the best part of that, the best part of that is when he's you look well. And she's like, yes. And then just when she says, we're having quite a lot of sex, the look on Sherlock's face is amazing. It was so good. I had to throw that in there because it's like one of my favorite lines ever. Yeah, just like the Stag Knight in general. I love that they're doing this pub crawl and then John is trying to sort of like manipulate it because he figures out what Sherlock's trying to do. So he adds that shot to Sherlock's beer so he gets completely off his face.
Yeah, but we have a bar fight, which might or might not be a reference to Charles Augustus Newton. Because he sort of pretends to get into a fight to get to information. So they might or might not be a canon reference. And then, of course, they found themselves on the stairs, completely drunk, forgetting, you know, what they're all about. And John sort of saying that he doesn't have an international reputation. And I bet we were all like, yeah, right, you do.
So they go upstairs and they start playing. And then just to unpack that for a second, because it's hilarious. All the things that John says about Sherlock, you know that he's talking about Sherlock. And so you're thinking to yourself, okay, this actually, you know, this is really obvious. And then when Sherlock says, I know who it is, it's you. I went backward and I'm like, wait, What is that saying about, like, the ways that Sherlock thinks of John? Like,
yeah.
If you look at it backwards, he's like, okay, so you're very, very important to some people. You're clever. It means that he thinks that he's very clever. It means that he thinks that he's nice sometimes. It means that he thinks that he is not as tall as people think, which does that mean that he feels like John... Like, I was just trying to unpack that a little. Does that mean that he thinks that John has this bigger presence than John actually has? Because John, you know, Martin Freeman's, what, like 5'6"? Does that mean that, like, Sherlock thinks that when John Watson walks into a room, people have this larger impression of him as a personality and as a force and as a you know, like, a character than he actually is in height? And I was just trying to go backwards through that going, man, like... Your impressions of John Watson are really interesting, dude.
Yeah, and the other one is the King of England, which I just love. And John's just laughing.
That was so funny.
Am I a King of England?
No. You know we don't have a king, and that's another, like, that's so canon. You know, there's that bit where he says, I don't care who's the current king, or whether the sun goes round the earth or the other way around, and, you know, I thought that was a nice nod to that.
Even in the canon, he has, like, a picture of Queen Victoria, like, on his wall. I often wonder,
yeah,
like,
just
how
so that he shoots
her initials into the wall. Yeah, so that was very interesting. And then we have lots of knee touching and almost falling off chairs and stuff.
Yeah, like, it's going to make a lot of people happy. But also, it shows just, like, how really good friends are when they're completely smashed.
Yeah.
Like, I thought it was just so well done, so, like, realistically done also, because I was thinking, like, I would totally do this. Like, this is totally, like, how I am drunk. And, like, Taylor and I were talking about this, just, like, how the camera then shifts to sort of drunkovision, where, like, the edges are all blurred, and you're like, yes, this is completely how it looks when you are so drunk that you cannot, sit up. Because, like, when, like, the client gets there, like, they're both just like, oh,
it's
God.
So
and then the white letters of drunkovision are hilarious. He's, like, deducing that furniture is furniture.
My favorite is deaded.
Deaded. Yeah. Sorry, like, the egg-shaped chair thing where he doesn't even, he's like, is that a chair? Egg-shaped thing. Chair, like, oh, it's amazing.
It says, like, sitting thing on it as well. Like, yeah, sitting, like, thing. Sitting thing.
But it might be a bad time to try to solve a case. They just run with it.
It's so funny how he tries to get his little set out of his coat pocket, and he just almost falls on his face, and then he face plants on the carpet, awful. And then I was just laughing tears at that moment.
Oh man. It's just so good. Just the cluing for looks. He's cluing for looks.
He's cluing for looks.
Yeah, and then of course
he makes a little hand gesture, like, "Yep, I said that."
Yeah. Oh god. Yeah, and then they're in jail, and then Greg is just yelling at them because they're hungover, and he just enjoys the hell out of it. It's one of the funniest parts.
Cumberbatch's delicate little walk when he leaves the jail cell is, like, my favorite thing, where he's like, his head's gonna fall off, pretty much.
Yeah.
Just, like, you know, this? You've had that feeling what before where your head might fall off.
Yeah. And I love the, how, like, pissed off he was as well. He was like, oh, goddamn, that could have been a really good case. And we were so drunk.
Yeah, but of course then he goes on to trying to solve the case, and then we have a beautiful example of the Wayne Paliskin, in which he sort of transfers the bunch of the chat room into a courtroom, which is amazing. I love that.
It's so well done.
Like,
it's so interesting.
Really
I have some, I have some thoughts about this.
Go for it.
Then please chat.
Yeah. Okay, sorry, but I had to look up something on Wikipedia, like, really quick to remind myself, but, like, the thing that struck me about the scene, especially, like, when Mycroft begins talking to Sherlock, it's as if he's kind of absorbed some of Mycroft into his mind, the same way if you look at the first episode where John is talking to him whilst he's doing his deductions. And it made me think of something that's been said sometimes about Star Trek, in which the three main characters, which is obviously Captain Kirk, Spock. I can't believe I just forgot what he was called. I'm
pointy
sorry.
Ear guy.
The pointy eared guy. And McCoy.
The guy who's
and
in
how...
Bilbo Baggins. Yeah.
Yes, that one. And how they form the parts of the mind, as in the id, the ego, and the superego. So my thought was that
Mycroft, the
superego, which is the critical and moralizing role, actually is John. So John is the superego. Mycroft is the id, and then Sherlock is the ego, like the bit that kind of communicates between the superego and the id. So Mycroft is the extreme expression of Sherlock's like very logical mind, whereas John is his expression of things to do with emotions, and like it's almost as if he has like taken those characters like into his mind, and even the woman, as he said, has become part of his mental landscape, which I think is really fascinating in terms of like the internal psychology of Sherlock.
I don't know if he's part of his mental landscape. This that he was when he was going through the Haymitch thing that. All of a sudden, she popped up. I don't think she's incredibly involved, but she's in
She's
her-
in. She's sort of in there.
I don't think she's a big part of it.
No, not as much as Mycroft and John.
It was really cool to see Laura Pulver.
Yeah. it was like the visualization of...
I was just going to say, I thought that was a very small nod to the canon concept that Irene Adler is someone that Sherlock Holmes never quite completely figures out. I don't think she's like on his mind 900 times a day, but she's kind of in a slightly unfinished thing that's kind of hanging out there.
Yeah, that's fair.
Yeah, and then we sort of skip back to the speech, which is, you know, happening all the while, basically, because he's still telling people about their adventures. And then he proposes a toast. And then he notices, because the photographer is basically jumping in his face, very similar to how he notices the cabbie in Study in Pink. He notices that, you know, that person is somehow a clue to something important. And then the speech is... drifts into awkward. I love that when he just starts to, okay, I have to keep talking now. How do I do this? You know? And then he obviously jumps into Sherlock mode. And it just becomes sort of really funny while he tries to actually figure out who's the target, of someone who is there to kill someone. And then we just have this lovely moment of him excluding, different parties and people, from being the actual, sort of person who's
because that's when he kind of accesses the part of his mind he kind of thinks of as John Watson, because at first he's trying to figure out who the killer is, and he's like, no, I have to find out who the victim is, which is what John would think to do first. So that's him kind of, you know, taking on board that part of his mind.
I have really intense feelings about this whole sequence of scenes, because I have this theory that Sherlock is completely broken, like there's something up, because there's in Empty Hearth, like, the Mind Palace isn't working. He's, like, emotionally frantic. In this one, it happens a few times. Like, one more deduction than I was expecting. But there's the scene, and it completely mimics the really lovely scene in the first Robert Downey Jr. Sherlock Holmes, when it becomes too much. And he completely, like, I think he says there's too much, there's too much, too much. Because, like, the Mayfly man is just popping up everywhere. And it completely, like, fills the screen. And then when he's trying to narrow it down, and like Mycroft is goading him, and he's like, "Don't fuck it up, like you do this, don't do this, don't fail." And when he physically like abuses himself, I'm like, "Oh my god,
something is
broken in him." And I don't know if it's something emotional, if it's from the hiatus. I don't know if it's a mixture of the two, but there's just something, and I'm just like, "Oh my god, my baby."
Yeah. Well. Someone I think on Tumblr did point out that they think that he might be displaying certain elements of PTSD, that he might be suffering from something that happened during the hiatus, that he's attempting to ignore, like, you know, push it right down, but it's sort of manifesting in the way that he behaves.
Yeah, like, I wish I knew more about, like, just psychology. Yes. Does anyone have, like, any other thoughts on this?
Well, we saw enough of the hiatus. Well, the only bits that we saw were really dark, you know? We didn't see much of the hiatus, but the parts that we did see were extraordinarily, terribly, terribly, horribly dark. I mean, if that was, you know, if just that 5 minutes was the entire hiatus, you could still easily have PTSD from that. So this is 2 years of you know, being away from everything you really care about, and it would have taken an enormous toll, I think.
Well, I think it has to do with focus as well, because the moment we just talked about with the Mind Palace, I mean, he gets distracted, right? John shows up in it, which did never happen before. Like, if John talked, Sherlock would just ignore it. Like, he would take forever to even you know, recognize that somebody's talking. But John broke in. Then we have the woman appearing, you know, out of nowhere, basically, in that sequence. So I think it might actually, because, I mean, that's sort of what I do, is like, or what the general I hit myself in the face thing comes from. If you want to focus on something, and but you're distracted by other thoughts, and I think that's just, they might not be as extreme as post-traumatic stress disorder, but something that keeps him from concentrating the way he used to. And I wonder if, I mean, it might have to do with the hiatus, but it might also have to do with the fact that he's changing as a person, that he does recognize, you know, social norms and all of those people. And so I think it might just be his concentration slipping and the problem that he has in focusing now. So that was sort of what I felt.
I have a thought, too. It's really interesting to me that going back to season one, in the confrontation at the pool when we see John in danger, I think that was one of the first times, you know, there's the whole conversation in season one, will caring about them help save them, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Now we're all the way to season three where we have Sherlock who does care about people. And for me, it was wondering, how does actually having a very strong emotional attachments, having a time where he says, this is the only vow I'm ever going to make in my life is to care about these people. How does that affect his mental processes? Are we seeing Sherlock proved right in the sense that becoming a more whole and, you know, holistically rounded person, what does that do for someone who has previously been, in his own mind at least, kind of a computing, deducting machine? And I think it's interesting to consider, does caring, the question at least is out there to me, does caring about them actually make it harder to save them? And I'm assuming we're going to see that kind of play out. But for me, it was not necessarily connected to the hiatus as much as, like Maria was just saying, what, how is he changing as a person, and how does being that emotionally attached to people, and as he changes and becomes attached to John and Mary, how does that affect his attachment to Mycroft and to other people that he cares about, and what does that mean for the purity or what have you of his mental processes?
Which is so canonical, all of it, because you've got, you know, throughout so many of these cases, he's saying things like, you know, strong emotion biases the judgment. I would never marry myself for that reason. I, you know, and sentiment is all very well and good, but it, you know, it is something that biases people and it clouds the logical faculty. And he really believes that, I think. And he, because he is a truly caring person deep down, no matter how hard he believes that, he doesn't really have the option of just shutting off completely and becoming this finely honed reasoning machine that he might want to be. That, because, you know, I've always thought that Sherlock Holmes as a person, it's not, he doesn't shut off emotions, I don't think, because he is uncaring ever, but I think he cares a lot when they are turned on. And so he is so passionate, and he's so, it's so obvious how passionate he is, right? And he is such a passionate human that when he is passionate about something, he has to distance himself to a certain extent, because otherwise it would be completely overwhelming. And I've always thought that it was because of the great heart part of him, as well as the great brain, that's why he has to be that detached, because otherwise he would just drown in it and be completely unable to function.
Yeah, so I said maybe it's like a balancing thing, that he's not quite sure how to balance it yet.
Yeah, possibly. I mean, one of the other big character changes, obviously, is when the way that he speaks to the head bridesmaid, which was just delightful. I mean, obviously there was no intent behind it, but like those two like flirted like crazy. But it was so it was done so funny, and they obviously, like, by the end of it, like, you know, he they quite respected each other enough to sort of tease each other, and it was just you would never, like, in the first two series really have seen Sherlock do that with anyone, but he took the time to, you know, speak to her and form, like, a, you know, sort of acquaintanceship with, you know, someone outside of his little circle. Yeah, become her wingman, basically.
I think this is just brilliant.
A little bit of a canon reference. Is it in The Lion's Mane when he talks about meeting the woman that he admires? Not that he would ever. He says it's the one that Sherlock himself narrates and says, she's the most complete woman I've ever met, even though I don't think about women or something. I'm having like a mental block on her name.
Maude Bellamy.
Could be, yeah.
Oh.
Thank you.
There you go.
I think it's umbrella effect again, quite frankly. I think it's this whole umbrella effect concept where this is Mary's best friend. This is the head bridesmaid. So I have to talk to her.
Yeah, that's
and
true.
I have to you know, because Mary is part of John, and so now this person is part of Mary, and, you know, in a lesser degree, I have to communicate with her in a way that I would not ordinarily have communicated with people before these other people became really important to me. And I love the progression between season two specifically, when he cannot remember a single one of John's girlfriend's names ever.
Yeah.
Like, there is zero names that are like, that make it into his database. He's just like, you know, the boring teacher and the one with the hair and the, you know, she had the nose and like that person. And then you've got the running joke still, but still he cannot bring himself to remember Lestrade's first name. He cannot physically bring himself to remember Lestrade's name. It's Greg. So you've still got that, but then it's like, so, you know, it would be so easy for them to make the obvious joke where he can't, you know, really process Mary's either. But he's really on it. He's just like, Mary, no, I need to talk to her. I need to ask her opinion of this. I need to, you know, be on the same page with her. And I think that his relationship with that head bridesmaid is sort of an extension of this, where it's like, okay, more people are important. So now you have to be dealt with in a way that I wouldn't normally deal with just, you know, the regular tide of humanity. You have to be spoken to as a person.
And well, I think that's really important for his development.
And that sort of brings us to the solution, or how Sherlock actually solves the case, which has to do with Hamish, which has to do with John's middle name, which is sort of the final clue, which brings him to sort of unravel the mystery of the two cases, of the ghost husband case that he pukes on the carpet while trying to solve, and Bainbridge, which is of course then leads him, or which leads him to the stepped soldier.
Now,
but does anyone find that medically pretty improbable, though?
I mean, the belt would have to be quite tight for it to act as a tourniquet, but you can stab people without them noticing.
You can.
It's like a really small cut, and it's sort of really deep.
Yeah, I think because it was so fine, and that it was on a... I was on a point that was already being pressed, and like, you wouldn't necessarily be numb because of that belt, but because like when you wear something like a tight belt or something, then you're just kind of like meh. So it's completely medically probable, like especially with such a fine blade.
When Sherlock mentions that it was not just planned but rehearsed, that brought me right back to Silver Blaze, where the guy who. goes and nicks the horse's legs, first practices on the sheep, and he notices because a few of them have gone lame.
Yeah.
Brilliant.
Good cast.
Nice.
So, and then, of course, he sort of figures it out, and then we have this extremely emotional scene in which basically Mary and Sherlock save Sholto's life for the sake of John, which is really neat, and it shows again how how complex Mary is and how much she understands and how intelligent she is, because she can read people in a really nice way, in sort of an emotional way that Sherlock can read clues. She reads emotions. And I really love how they characterize her in this, and how she knows exactly how Sholto will react to what they say. So that was a really intense moment, I found.
Yeah, because everything that Sherlock does, saying, like, we wouldn't do this at John's wedding. Like, we need to not do this. And the entire episode, everything that Sherlock does is for John. So it was just another, like, a little tick. It was nice.
A lovely little one. And then we have the dance, and Sherlock playing violin.
It's revealed that, you know, Sherlock does like to dance. That is canon now.
Ballet lock is canon.
The spin.
I didn't even think of that.
And, of course, there's...
Oh, my God.
There's a little mention of the fact that Sherlock taught John how to dance as well.
Yeah.
Behind closed curtains.
Well, that's gotta be.
This is how some came in once.
Yep.
Between A Game of Shadows and that reference, I'm just like, okay. You know what? They dance.
Yeah,
canon.
That happened.
They dance. Yeah. They danced.
And then we have, of course, the lovely accidental deduction of, you know, the three of them. Which I just found really, really sweet. But then, of course, everybody's just shocked for a moment. And then Sherlock is actually the one to talk them around to it being okay. It's going to be okay. So that was a really sweet thing for him.
But it's like not going to be okay.
No. I know it's not going to be okay, but let's not think about that now.
Yeah, that's not going to
It's not. not gonna be okay.
Yeah, but we're still happy. And I really like the fact that he not only sort of gave the best man speech, but he also sort of opened this new chapter he was talking about for them in their new life, which sort of excludes him, I think, in a way. He excludes himself from that in, you know, saying it's going to be the three of you and not the three of us anymore. So I found that really quite interesting, that he took a step back. And then, of course, he fulfilled the prophecy by leaving the party early. And that's when the egg starts.
Oh no.
It's going to be horrible. Next week's going to be horrible.
Every single time he does that, though, and sort of absents himself, every time he takes a step backward out of respect or you know, affection, they take another one forward. So he'll say something like, okay, well, you go dance. And then Mary's like, yeah. But what about you?
Yeah.
And but what about you, Sherlock Holmes? And Sherlock's like, I'm not going to dance with you. He's like, there are limits. But every time he sort of backs away because he thinks that's what he's supposed to do, because he's heard it now from like 8 million quarters that that's what he's supposed to do, either John will say, you know, you don't have to worry about this, right? Because we're still going to do this. Or Mary will be like, go solve crime, or you should dance with us. And it becomes this sort of, you know, really sweet give and take between all three of them, where, you know, he's trying not to overstep anything and they're assuring him that he's not.
Yeah, I think that's because it's like a very early stage of them. It's like a very early stage of them deciding that they can define their friendship however they want. And like Sherlock hasn't really learned yet that he doesn't have to follow all of these rules. You know, he's being told this is what he should do, but then they're saying, no, you don't have to do that. Like, you're not like, you know, you need to do these things. Like, we can define our friendship however we want.
But I'm just so scared for next week. Especially with the podcast. Like, there's no way in the world that this can be good. Like, in any scenario I can imagine, it's going to be terrible.
They're going to kill us. They're going to kill us.
Yeah.
They're going to kill someone.
Yeah. Gonna kill
poor taste. Poor taste.
If not two people.
Oh, God. Oh.
You know, there's this back of my head thing that is trying to make me not, like, just fall into a curled up fetal weeping position every 10 seconds or so, that reminds me, like, well, maybe they really want Amanda Abington back for the next season. So, you know, maybe.
maybe she's gonna put her heel into.
Exactly. Take that and that and that and that and that. You know,
that'd be so good. Oh, it'd be so awesome.
God, I'm so worried. So worried,
yeah,
because
I know, right?
It's because of the canon that we're so worried. Exactly. Yeah, and like, yeah. John Watson doesn't have any children, you know?
Exactly. Damn, you are Arthur Conan Doyle.
Yeah. Not happy. It's not going to be nice.
And especially since they make us love Mary so much, it's just going to suck so badly.
Yeah.
Pretty much.
They've really written her so well. And
they
Amanda
have.
Abington, obviously.
They really have.
Super charming in the first place, but it's just written perfectly, you know? Like, crime-fighting enabler. And just all around warm. I love that comment of Watson's in the canon where he says that people who are in trouble flock to her like birds to a lighthouse. It's beautiful. And you know, like, it really seems like she's got this empathy, these levels of empathy with the people she has conversations with, including, you know, Sherlock, where she says to him earlier in the episode, he says, oh no, I know how to fold napkins. And she's like, I'm not John. I know when you're lying. It was so great. And he's like, all right, I got it off YouTube, whatever. But the point is that she's got such heart, and I think he really respects that. And the ultimate compliment he pays her when he says he thinks she deserves to marry him. Is like completely gorgeous, and I'm not ready for the third episode.
No.
It could have been so easy to make it a really horrible storyline with Mary coming in and breaking everything up, and you know, but it was actually a proper triangle that had three sides, and it was lovely, and I was just sitting there watching it going, wow, this is just really nice, and this is what I want, and I didn't expect that.
Yeah, it just makes me really happy, and I think I mean, all of this drama that went on concerning Mary and the fandom, I think they really, you know, there will always be people who will hate, you know, something, but I think, you know, she's doing all right. I mean, she's not a character who breaks up anything. She's not a character who disturbs the friendship. She like furthers it. She gives it another level. So I think people will really, really like her as this character, even those who were afraid of it.
So. Yeah, and like the only reason that they would break up in any sense is that because it's Sherlock taking the step back. Like they, as you said, Lindsay, like they keep taking that step forward. Like, no, it's all of us. It's all of us. And Sherlock's now the one who's leaving ahead of time.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I have to throw in a Doctor Who reference. It reminded me a lot of the wedding of Amy and Rory when the Doctor tries to leave and they follow him. It reminded me of that a lot because you keep talking about the concept of him stepping back and them stepping forward. I really love that dynamic that there's like this third odd person, but this person is just as much a part of the friendship as the other two people are in a different way.
Yeah, and canonically when Sherlock Holmes says about her, oh no, it's not that I don't like her, she's brilliant. He's like, she could have been super useful solving crime at the end of Sign of Four. When he's like, she had this great instinct about which letters to keep and she's super smart. Like, God, it's such a great canon moment. He's like, we could use her solving crime. No, it's fine. I mean, I really can't congratulate you because you're like in love and that's gross. But anyway, she's great.
Yeah. All right. Any further remarks on this episode?
I mean, did you want to get out your military feelings, Artie? Because we get to see John's military chops.
See, I was going to be quiet about this because I thought we only have an hour. And if we want to talk about my feelings about John the military man and John having a life outside of Sherlock and John being a fucking doctor and stressing that point twice in this episode, then we're going to need more than an hour to do that. But if you put me on the spot like that, I just want to say, because the thing about the show is, it can be really insular, like Sherlock and John contra mundum. You know, it's the two of us and the rest of the world doesn't really get a look in and doesn't really understand. But it's when you go outside of that and explore, you know, what other people are there and what, you know, what life does John Watson have outside of Sherlock. That was another thing that I really wanted for series two, and I sort of got it with Baskerville because they went with a military setting, and it's the same with this episode. They delve into his past as a doctor and as a military man, and it's at that point when you throw all that into the mix that you start getting an interesting story and an interesting character, because Sherlock Holmes is the man that we know nothing about canonically, and that's what makes him interesting. But John Watson, we actually know quite a bit about, and it's all stuff that, you know, can be shown and that we like to see, or at least, you know, I like to see. I'd like to see a lot more of, actually, but, you know, as it was. And I thought it was really neat that they made Major Short or his old CO and gave him that backstory of, you know, he never goes out because he took a troop of recruits on whatever exercise and they all died, basically. I just appreciate when they incorporate that, because that's when good stories happen, and I just think they should do it more because...
Well, it was also really good storytelling.
It's a big recipe that works.
Yeah, exactly. And like the victim is somebody who is actually close and dear to John Watson. So the fact that that person is important to him makes the entire case that much more, the stakes are higher. And this was the major problem I had with The Empty Hearse, was that we could have had a Moran who was important to Moriarty. And we didn't have a Moran who even had a single, you know, like line of dialogue throughout the entire thing. And so that case I found to be so slender as to be, you know, just like almost ridiculous. But this one, the victim involved, like not only did it play with the backstory of my personal favorite character, Mr. Doctor and Captain John Watson, it not only did it play with his background, which is perfect for an episode about his wedding, but the victim was also someone who he cares deeply about. And that's just, like, much, much better storytelling. Like, in terms of the way the case operated, woven throughout the best man speech throughout this episode, I just thought it was phenomenally better written as case fic and as a screenplay and as, you know, just good, solid storytelling this time around. Yeah. I was totally satisfied with it.
Definitely. Absolutely.
Yeah, I agree.
On that note, I think we can wrap this up. Our 50th. What?
50th episode.
Woohoo! Woo! Party and streamers!
His Last Vow premieres on BBC One on January the 12th. So, yeah. Look forward to that.
If this quotidian world has got you crying, won't you too?